the point that you're adding this fresh microcarriers is critical. So as the cells grow, aggregation of the microcarriers sets in. And if you have a too high level of aggregation, the cells lose this ability to jump from one bead to another.
Hey, smart biotech scientists, welcome back. We are in the middle of a conversation about the production of cultivated meat with my guest, Petra Hanga, who is a lecturer in biochemical engineering at the University College in London. And if you haven't listened to part one yet, please go back and listen first to part one. And today we're continuing our journey and looking at the specifics of the cultivated meat production. We're going to talk about microcarriers. And towards the end, we're going to make it very practical so that you can get started and develop a robust and cost-efficient cultivated meat process. So stay tuned. Are you juggling the complexities of CMC development while trying to enjoy the beauty of biotech? Have you ever wondered if there's a way to simplify bioprocessing? Welcome to the Smart Biotech Scientist podcast, where we're diving headfirst into the very challenges you face. We're breaking it down, demystifying the jargon, and giving you the keys to unlock your full potential. I'm your host, David Brohlman, and I get it. With 15 plus years in the biotech industry, I face the same challenges you do. There's a way to simplify and streamline so you can remove complexity, you can skip trials and errors, deliver without delay your groundbreaking therapy to clinics at market, and still enjoy every single step. Do you want to learn how industry experts and I did it? Grab a cup of coffee and your favorite notebook and pen. Now is the time to take your bioprocessing game to the next level. Let's smarten up biotech. Now let's move into the more technical part of the cultivated meat. And you mentioned it before that to produce cultivated meat, we are using cells, more specifically stem cells. Could you please elaborate on the significance on these stem cells and why this is a great option?
Going back to the structure of cultured meat, you need those muscle cells, you need the fat cells, you need the connective cells. Mature, differentiated cells, if you take them directly from the tissue, they're quite limited in how much they can grow. So that wouldn't be a feasible way of making the cultured meat, because you would only be able to produce very small quantities. So one option of bypassing some of that limitation would be to use stem cells. And stem cells are these undifferentiated cells that you can, I don't really like this word, but I'm going to use it, you can manipulate to drive them to form muscle, to form fat, to form fibroblasts. So the cell types that you're interested in for cultured meat. And of course, not all stem cells are equal. So there are different types of stem cells, and they all have different needs in terms of how you can culture them, and also different potential for differentiation. That's what I'm referring to. So some companies are going down the route of using, for example, pluripotent stem cells, which can form both muscle and fat. I guess the issue with these is that if we think about sourcing primary cells, sourcing pluripotent stem cells, and just pluripotent stem cells, it's an even bigger hurdle because from what I know, there's only one company which is based in the UK that actually has managed to produce iPSCs, induced pluripotent stem cells, from porcine. And I think they also have lamb. There might be some others in the world, but I'm only aware of this one. So getting those cells in the first place would be a huge hurdle, plus all those other things that go into growing those pluripotent stem cells. So a more approachable option would be to use adult stem cells. So adult stem cells are basically mesenchymal stem cells that you can isolate from different tissues, and is the same in animals. So the same in cows, the same in pigs. You can isolate them from bone marrow, you can isolate them from fat. And there has been a lot of research on human mesenchymal stem cells. So I don't think there has been, or at least I haven't seen any on bovine or porcine, but there is this idea that the stem cells will have almost like a memory. So if, for example, you isolate them from fat, they will tend to make fat a lot easier, or they would be more prone to make fat a lot easier. If you isolate them from bone marrow, it would be easier to differentiate them towards bones, so towards osteogenic lineage. So getting adipose-derived stem cells, it's actually a lot easier, a lot more accessible, and they have this capability of forming fat. There have been a few studies where there was suggested that these cells can also be transdifferentiated to muscle. But to be honest, we've tried it in-house and it hasn't really worked. So I'm not quite sure about that. But on the muscle side, the other option, which again is more accessible, is to isolate muscle stem cells or myosatellite cells. So these normally in vivo, in the body, they would be quiescent, meaning they would be inactivated. And they would only be activated when there's some sort of damage to muscle. So they would travel there and essentially repair the muscle fibers. But we can culture them in vitro and make enough of them. And then you just differentiate them towards muscle. And it's a lot easier for them to be differentiated towards muscle. So a lot of the companies have actually taken this approach of using myosatellites for muscle and using mesenchymal stem cells, particularly adipose-derived stem cells or fibroidal progenitors, to make the fat element.
So what I'm hearing, Petra, is that it's easier to start out with different types of cells because they will differentiate into muscle cells or more fat cells. And it's very difficult to start with one type of cell that will differentiate in all kinds of different tissues, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, with iPSCs, they're absolutely amazing cells, but they are a lot more sensitive, so a lot more difficult to grow. Ideally, when you're developing a manufacturing process, you would want the simplest option, because the simplest, the less steps, the better it is, the better cell yields you would have, less things to go wrong. So obviously, sometimes that's not possible. So you kind of have to choose the worst scenario or worst or best.
Yeah, I totally agree that in manufacturing, you wanted to keep it simple and especially consistent and reproducible. And now you said that cells have memory. So there's a memory effect, which leads me to the question about expansion, because you have to be very careful to have the right conditions in order to then, at the end of the day, have the right cell, correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So every single type of cells will have their own requirements in terms of the media formulation. To give you an example, myosatellite cells, so muscle stem cells, they need a lot of protein, which in a way, if you think about in the real life with muscle building and so on, that's only achieved by having enough protein. So with myosatellites, generally you would have a high percentage of serum in there. If you're using a serum-based media, so we're talking about 20%. Some of the other cell types, like the adipose-derived stem cells, only have 10% serum in. So they don't have the same requirement for protein, but they have other requirements. They might need some extra growth factors to be able to grow, etc. So understanding your cell type is really, really important, first of all, from the nutritional point of view. Nutritional as in the media formulation for the cells. But then there are some common elements or common themes, hurdles, I don't know how you want to call them, that when you're developing bioprocesses in bioreactors, you always need to look for. And these are really important because they can stop cell growth, right? So you don't want that. That's the last thing you want. When you expand them, you want to get as many cells as possible. Those kind of hurdles are running out of surface area. So most stem cell types, unless they're isolated from blood, like hematopoietic stem cells, but those only form blood cells, so they don't have an applicability in cultured meat. Most of stem cell types are what we call adherent dependent cells. So they need a substrate to attach to anchor to in order to grow. So when they run out of the surface area, then they physically do not have where else to grow, right? Because they've covered the entire surface. So they will just stop growing. They will go into a plateau of cell growth. The other thing that can limit the growth is the depletion of glucose. So glucose is the source of carbon. So it's really, really important for all cell types, stem cells. It doesn't really matter what kind of cell you're using. Once they don't have a source of carbon, again, they're not going to have the energy. They're not going to have the sources to make the energy that they need. So they're going to stop growing. Another thing that can limit growth is accumulation of metabolites. So as part of the cell growth process, so the metabolism of the cells, glucose is consumed and lactate or lactic acid is produced. Ammonia is also part of that metabolite. So if these accumulate in culture and they reach certain concentrations, which are different for each cell type, those can become toxic to the cells. So in the first instance, they would inhibit cell growth, but then it can also kill the cells if they're reaching too high concentrations. And of course, that's not something that you want in your processes. And then I guess another thing that it's important to look for, especially when you're working in bioreactors, is the agitation speed that you use if you're using a stirred tank bioreactor. And well, actually, that can translate to any type of reactor. So what you want to do is you want to avoid shear stress on the cells that can cause damage.
Yeah, and shear stress, that's a good point because we work with cells that are very sensitive, and your team has developed a microcarrier-based process. So can you tell us why this approach is changing the game and why you're solving many of these issues you just elaborated on?
One really important challenge in making cultivated meat and growing cells for cultivated meat is the cell density. And obviously, bypassing all these limitations or all these hurdles that I've just spoken about. And we've come up with a strategy where we can bypass the surface area limitation. And we do that by basically giving the cells fresh surface area. So the surface area in this context is the microcarriers. Will act as the attachment substrates for the cells when we grow them in the bioreactors. And by adding fresh microcarriers at a very critical point in culture, the cells have this ability. So it's something that in the literature has been referred to as the bead-to-bead transfer phenomenon, which basically means that the cells have the ability to jump from one bead to another and populate fresh beads. So the point that you're adding this fresh microcarriers is critical. So as the cells grow, aggregation of the microcarriers sets in. And if you have a too high level of aggregation, the cells lose this ability to jump from one bead to another. So when you add the fresh microcarriers, it needs to be done at a point where there will be a low level of aggregation, but it wouldn't be severe enough to inhibit that phenomenon, if that makes sense. That was what we played on by doing this simple step, because it's quite a simple step. What we managed to achieve was to increase the cell density. And that is pretty critical because if you manage to get high cell densities without compromising the quality of the cells, you can actually get away with using smaller scales because the larger you go in your bioreactors, the engineering challenges for that. So it's not even the biological challenges. At that point, the engineering challenges are the ones that will take over. And I think a lot of people probably underestimate those challenges with scale up, but they can be quite significant. So if you can get away with not having to scale up to, I don't know, 1,000 liters, and you can do your process at 200 liters, but still getting the same amount of cells at the end, I mean, that is a huge win.
Working at a smaller scale, obviously, yes, I totally agree. You solve certain engineering problems. Now I'm just still wondering, because you're using microcarriers and this scaling up a microcarrier process is not that easy. But I'd say even to 50 liter or 200 liter can be challenging. What are certain methods we can use as scientists and engineers to still succeed, even if we go, I'd say, to an intermediate size?
I think the challenge is not necessarily in growing the cells on the microcarriers. That's easy. I mean, we've done it for over a decade now, a lot with human cells, but also with bovine and porcine cells. The challenge in larger scales, including, let's say, 5 liters, 20 liters, 50 liters, is more of maintaining sterility. That can be quite an issue. And also an issue is harvesting at the end and getting rid of the microcarriers. So generally, at least with the commercially available microcarriers, these tend to be polystyrene-based, right? So plastic. So clearly, they're not fit for purpose for cultured meat. But if there's no other option, then you have to use those. So in our work, that was what we used. I would have preferred to use edible microcarriers or microcarriers that can basically be, I don't know, at the end of the process, they can be broken down without damaging the cells. And the reason for that is because that would have made the harvesting process a lot easier. So the challenge is when you have these polystyrene-based microcarriers, to harvest the cells, you need to use proteolytic enzymes. So generally, it's a combination of intense agitation to kind of give the cells that kick to get off the beads, and the proteolytic enzyme treatment, which tends to be a lot longer than what you would use when you grow the cells in flasks. But that combination can affect the quality of the cells. And then after you've managed to detach the cells from the microcarriers, then there has to be a step where you separate the microcarriers from the cells. So there has to be some sort of filtration. But the trick is that there aren't really many technologies available on the market that you can use that have the pores large enough, because you can't use 0.2 micrometers. That's the kind of standard for sterilizing things. But if you use 0.2 micrometers, you're not going to get your cells going through the pores. You're not going to be able to separate them. So you need pores small enough to retain the microcarriers, but then large enough to allow the cells to pass through in the liquid phase. And we used to do it when we were running liter scale bioreactors. So having 1 liter, let's say, as a volume, we used to use these filtering tubes, which are called SteriFlip. I think they're from Millipore. I don't know if I can say it, but but the problem with those is that they can only process 50 milliliters at a time. So you can imagine when you had a 1 liter volume, how many of those tubes you needed. That was very, very laborious, to say the least. So that's one of the big limitations, because there aren't really many technologies that can allow you to do that. But if you would have a microcarrier that, for example, can be broken down by just adding something to your media, or they can be manipulated. So if, for example, they're responsive to a certain stimuli and you can use that to detach the cells, I mean, those are absolutely amazing technologies. Or even edible microcarriers. Why not in the cultured meat? Maybe it's not even necessary to harvest the cells from the microcarriers if they're edible. Maybe those microcarriers can be part of the final product and they can contribute. Maybe they can bring, I don't know, a contribution to not the taste, but the texture.
Now, smart biotech scientists, let's make this very practical. So let's roll up our sleeves and get to work. Petra, can you describe the essential steps we as scientists should take to develop a robust, a scalable, and cost-efficient cultivated meat production process?
That is a big question, to put it that way. I think maybe the biggest advice I can give when developing a process like this is first to know your cells really well. So know your cells in monolayer, how they grow. So have that sort of baseline of growth and quality to start with. And then once that's known, then take it a step at a time in terms of determining what the optimal parameters are, like seeding density, feeding regime. So all this development work needs to be done before you can actually move into liter scale bioreactors. Because once you move into liter scale bioreactors, obviously there's a larger cost associated with it. There's a lot more work going into it. So you don't want to waste that work. Before you get into that liter scale and 5 liters and 20 liters and 50 liters, you first need to have a really good handle on how to grow these cells in smaller scale. And semi-controlled bioreactors like spinner flasks, they're absolutely fantastic to do this sort of developmental work because they only have 100 milliliter volume, some of them even smaller. But they provide you that agitation. So they provide you an environment where you can use microcarriers like you would use in the liter scale bioreactors. You have agitation. You don't have full control over parameters because you're still relying on the incubator. So finding the optimal process, so the optimal seeding density, optimal agitation, optimal feeding regime, all of those things in the smaller scale is absolute key before you move into liter scale. And then in liter scale, one thing that I have noticed in our work is that when you're working in fully controlled bioreactors, cells grow a lot better than in the semi-controlled, which is good, which is great. But that means that then at that point, you have other challenges that you need to think about. And those challenges are more around maintaining pH, maintaining dissolved oxygen. So you have to figure out what kind of oxygen requirements do your cells have in that particular system. There are some engineering calculations that can be done around that. You have an actual idea of what's needed. I guess the best advice is know your cells and do this developmental work before you jump into scale up. Because if you don't have that base, then scale up is going to be very, very risky. You might get it right on a first go. You might completely not. So it would be a gamble.
As we are wrapping up, Petra, what breakthroughs do you envision that could accelerate the path to widespread adoption of cultivated meat?
I think what would be very, very helpful for the industry is maybe the scaffolds, so the microcarriers, as I say, if appropriate, fit for purpose. I think that's the best word to use. Fit for purpose microcarriers would be developed that can simplify the bioprocess a lot. So that can help with that cell yield at the end. I think media formulations as well. There's a lot of potential for innovation there. So at the moment, a lot of processes and a lot of the work is done with serum-based media because there aren't options that are commercially available, at least not yet, or that are good enough. So I think once someone breaks that barrier and finds a formulation for serum-free media that will make the cells grow a lot better than serum-based media, I think that's going to be a huge breakthrough because that will help achieve those very high cell densities that I've mentioned earlier. So potentially smaller scales, but you're still getting a lot of material out of it.
We have covered a lot of ground today, Petra. What is the most important takeaway from our conversation?
I think it's in terms of bioprocessing, don't underestimate the challenges and do the groundwork because that's going to really help in the long term. I would say that's the takeaway.
Excellent. Thank you so much for sharing all your advice and thoughts and research, Petra. Where can people connect with you?
You can find me on LinkedIn if you search Petra Hanga. I'm also happy to connect with people on my UCL address. I'm happy to share that. Quest, through the Quest website or Quest LinkedIn, those are also options that you can find me.
I will leave all these information in the show notes, so please do take advantage and reach out to Petra. And once again, Petra, thank you very much for being on the show today.
Thank you very much for having me, David. It was my pleasure.
Hey, smart biotech scientists, you might be wondering how you can get started to develop a cost-efficient, robust, and scalable cultivated meat production process. You might feel a bit overwhelmed and just wondering, where should I start? So I want to make this very practical for you. I want to offer you a free 30-minute assessment just to get started and to look at your very specific challenges so that you can excel in the development and scale-up of cultivated meat production processes. So if this is for you, use the link down in the show notes and schedule a free call. All right, smart scientists. That's all for today on the Smart Biotech Scientist podcast. Thank you for tuning in and joining us on your journey to bioprocess mastery. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. By doing so, we can empower more scientists like you. For additional bioprocessing tips, visit us at smartbiotechscientist.com. Stay tuned for more inspiring biotech insights in our next episode. Until then, let's continue to smarten up biotech.